Introduce yourself, please.
How you doing? I'm Brandon Ellington, state representative from the 22nd District, and I'm also the chair of the Missouri Legislative Black Caucus.
Excellent. We're glad you're here. Let's play the music.
This is Statehouse Blend. I'm Sam Zeff.
And I'm Brian Ellison. We're using coffee
and donuts
to better understand the legislatures on both sides of the state line,
the issues and the people in Topeka
and Jeff City. Here we go. And welcome to the production studio here at KCUR 89.3. I'm Brian Ellison, and it is good to have Representative Brandon Ellington, who is a Democrat from Kansas City, with us. Thanks for being here.
No, it's fun. It was almost a tongue twister, though.
It is. Brian Ellison, Brandon Ellington. We're going to see how this goes. And then we have two guests who are both named Dan. Welcome to Dan Curry, who lives in the Troostwood neighborhood. Thanks for being here.
You bet.
He's an attorney and has lots of good questions ready to go. Dan Margulies of KCUR 89.3, also heads up our collaboration known as the Heartland Health Monitor. Welcome to you, Dan.
Good morning, Brian.
Glad you're here. So, Brandon, we have lots of important things to talk about today, and none more important than getting to know you first by asking you to tell us about any family, any kids, any pets you want to tell us about.
All right. I'm an avid animal lover. Currently, I have a dog, a cat. I have three kids. They're 5 twins, a boy and a girl. And then I have a 4-year-old boy.
Okay. So what are their names?
Brandon, Elijah, and Lyric.
All right. What are the pets' names? That's really the question.
Chewbacca. The cat doesn't have a name. The cat is a stray that I found a couple years ago. Never gave it a name. It doesn't meow. It kind of has a weird hissing thing that it does. and I didn't. I had it ever since I found it as a kitten, which was a couple years ago. The fish doesn't have a name either. Just call it fish.
Well, there's just these anonymous, nameless pets lurking around the Ellington household. Okay, that's good.
But the dog's name is Chewbacca, though.
Okay, Chewbacca, and he knows he comes when he's called.
Right? Yeah.
Okay. So the other question is, how did you get involved in politics in the first place?
That's an easy one. I started paying attention to the political arena around the time I was 19. And I got involved because I seen a lot of interactions in the inner city between police officers and misapplication of the law. Then I was blessed to go to UMKC when I was around 21, 22, and I actually studied political science and philosophy. And understanding the political paradigm, it made me want to get ultrally involved because I understood how we're actively socially colonized and separated.
Hmm. And what motivated you to seek elected office in order to address those concerns?
It's the only way you can deconstruct institutional barriers. No ifs, ands, or buts. Politics is a rules of engagement in America, and I believe if we had more citizens that was politically involved, we would not have the political problems and the lack thereof of political activity as far as addressing systemic issues that we currently have. So that's why I got involved.
So you've been very involved over the last couple of weeks with some of the events going on at Mizzou. You've led forums about that here in town at UMKC. I want to talk about a lot of that and about your work with the Missouri Legislative Black Caucus, but I always like to start by going around the table and asking our guests to share what's on their mind or what questions they have. Dan Margulies.
Sure. Well, Brandon, you know, I think a lot of people, and myself included, were a bit taken aback by the events of the last few weeks at Mizzou. I'm not a Mizzou grad, so I can't pretend to be as familiar with what's going on that campus as some of my colleagues here who did go there. But seemingly these events arose out of the blue to an outsider like myself, mm-hmm. But that isn't the case. Could you maybe explain for the benefit of some of our listeners the context in which these protests arose, leading to the resignations of both the president and the chancellor?
Now, I'm extremely glad you asked that question because this is one of the problems that I have with the students, and I talk to them about articulating, utilizing the media to get their message out. They have a document from 1969 that the so-called minority students in 1969 actually submitted to the college about improvements of race relations. The sentiments from the students currently today is almost identical to those documents in 1969. So some of the things that the students are asking for is diversity in the classroom, diversity in literature, actually having a university that takes reported issues of so-called minority threats, sexual assaults, et cetera, to heart and actually addressing those issues, and also having a voice via the student body with what happens on the college campus, which we see in certain other colleges with the student curators. So these are very palatable things that they're asking for. What we're seeing in mass media is that the students are aggressively protesting. That's not the case. When you go up there, you'll see originally the students was in the center of the college campus. They was not walking with signs. They was not doing anything. They was just simply demonstrating that they was no longer going to allow the racial mantra to continue. And one of the most important things that has not came out is some of the racial stereotypical dialogue that happens between professors and the students. And all of this goes into takes effect when we talked about the president resigning, not necessarily the chancellor resigning. It's been documented cases of the vice chancellor telling students derogatory comments in class, and the administration knows about this. So the students are extremely fearful. It's a lot of racial tension up there at that campus, but it didn't come out of the blue. It's documented cases from 1969 and also a documented piece of literature that they submitted to the college in 1969 that's almost identical when we talk about race relations, and none of it has been addressed.
So is the suggestion that no progress has been made since 1969 at Mizzou?
Very little. And you have to ask yourself a couple of things. When you have professors that make upwards of $100,000, I'm talking about African-American professors, and they don't stay on that campus no longer than 2 or 3 years, you have to ask yourself, why is somebody so quick to leave a $100,000-plus job? And the professors all articulate the racial climate at the campus and around the campus.
Which vice chancellor were you referring to?
I can't think of her name right now. But if you talk to the students up there, they will tell you her name. They will give you everything. If you talk to the administration, they will tell you that they know she's a problem. I apologize. I just can't think of her name.
That's all right. Do you feel like this story is not being told completely by the media? I hear you saying that there's things that are not being reported amid all of the conflict and sort of the good pictures of what's coming on from the campus.
No, I mean, it's not being reported. When you talk to the average person about what's happening at Mizzou, they say the students are protesting because they want people to resign. That's not the case. The students didn't ask for the chancellor's resignation. The only resignation that the students asked for was the president, President Wolf. They haven't asked for anybody else. They asked for diversity in literature, diversity in the classroom, et cetera. And none of this is being articulated in the media. Even the same when we talk about what's actually happening with the demonstrations and utilizing the word protest. When people hear the word protest, you think of proactive, aggressive movements. When you think about demonstrations, you think about people demonstrating what's happening. And when I say the students are not violently protesting, they're not. They're standing in one spot and they're articulating their concerns. They're passing out their papers about what their recommendations is and what they would like to see on that campus. When we talk about all the fallout, that has been from people outside of that campus. So when we talk about the vandalism, that's not the students demonstrating. When we talk about windows getting broke, that's not the students demonstrating. When we talk about terroristic threats towards the campus, that's not the students demonstrating. So all of the violent stuff is not coming from the students. And again, these are graduate-level students. So these aren't 17, 18, or 19-year-olds. These are 25, 26, 27-year-old students that have already proven themselves in the academic arena, so they're not unintelligent.
Let me just ask one quick question here, because you've said it twice, and I'd like a little clarification about what you mean. You say the students are demanding diversity in the classroom and in literature. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Okay, when you look at the makeup of the teaching staff up there, I think it's less than 2 or 3% so-called African-American, and less when you talk about Latino, Asian, or any other so-called minority groups. And when we talk about diversity in literature, when I went to UMKC, I studied philosophy. One of the first things that we learned studying philosophy is that the greatest Western philosophers studied in Africa, right? So if the greatest Western philosophers study from a different culture, it should be no problem having a diversified literature books on college campuses. College students should be allowed to read materials from people from the Asiatic continent, or Africa, or Indonesia, or wherever we want to go.
Are you saying those are not part of the curriculum?
From what I'm getting from the students, no. And we actually had a meeting with the Chancellor Lofton, And we had a meeting with the students when we went up there on Wednesday of this week, and it was me and about 10 other members from the Black Caucus. Each meeting lasted at least 2.5 hours, and we divulged deep into the student sentiments and what the college has not been doing. Both meetings were separate, so the meeting with the students, we got all the information from them, and then we sat down and met with the administration to not only verify what we was hearing from the students, but to get their side of the story too. So when we talk about lack of diversity in literature, it's not an opinion, it's a fact. And you can ask the administration and they can factually prove that they don't have diverse literature.
When you say diverse, just to be clear, when you say diverse literature, you are talking, strictly speaking, about literature, texts, however you want to characterize
books
it.
Books assigned in
books, right, assigned that were written by non-white males.
Well, not just non-white males, because when you talk about white, now we're talking about the social construct of race. We're not talking about culture. I'm talking about diversity via culture, not the social construct of race. So white folks aren't all European. Right, we have people from different continents, people from different cultures. So when we say diversity in literature, we're talking about true diversified literature materials, not the social construct of race and diversity.
Dan Curry, I want to get you into the conversation here. As you have been following the news this week, what's on your mind?
Well, one of the things that I've been thinking about is I wondered if the protesting students are, do they feel like they're getting closer to where they want to be through the protests? I guess two questions is, what are their goals and do they feel like any of them are being met?
Two separate goals. The short-term goals we got to address immediately. One of the goals was student safety. They felt like they was unsafe at the demonstration site. When we was on campus, the Black Culture Center actually got threatened when we were sitting there. They was complaining about lack of attention from campus police. And what I mean by lack of attention from campus police, it would be a report filed at, and I make up a time, at 10 a.m. and then the security would show up at 6 p.m. And this happened last year, too, with a rape case with a non-African-American. So they're asking for basic things, and they're also asking for immigrant students that come to the school to be made aware of all the different grants and different programs and different classes that they have on that campus. The diversity in the in the classroom is something that we're going to have to work on with the now permanent chancellor. Right now they have an interim chancellor, but with a permanent chancellor and a permanent president. So we can't work on systemic things until we get a permanent chancellor and a permanent president. But all of the short-term issues we actually immediately address via the last chancellor, Chancellor Lofton. So we was able to negotiate them being removed from the campsite, being placed in the student center, which gave them more security. We was able to negotiate a trifold with the state highway patrol, the county, and the campus police to get more security on that campus. And we also sent some things to the Attorney General and the FBI to retroactively go after some of the terroristic threats. But this goes into the tension on campus. When you have students that are in class and they're talking to their professor and they tell their professor that they're afraid for their life and can I make up a test? And the professor says no. That's scary. When you have threats being made via social media of mass killings, and we've seen mass killings in other states made via social media, and the campus seems not to address that issue seriously, that's scary. And particularly when you talk about the whole demographics around Columbia, around the campus, and the lack of organic support that you feel from administration. And the last thing I want to say is, if you look at the people that resigned, everybody that's leaving now, besides the person that the students wanted to leave, is people that was sympathetic to the people that was protesting. The chancellor was giving them water, he's gone. The coach came out and said he supported the team, he's gone. So all of this, people should actually pay attention to what's happening and not just what's being portrayed in 5-second sound bites.
I'm curious about how you got involved on the campus. And you were there with others from the Missouri Legislative Black Caucus. Did students call you and say, hey, we need some help here, we need some representatives? How did this happen?
I'm extremely proactive. So when we looked at what's happening on Mizzou, and Mizzou is one of our biggest recipients of state appropriations. So when we looked at what was happening on Mizzou, we had to go up there and we had to talk to people. So the first thing that I did was organize, me and Representative May, who's the vice chair of the caucus, organized a meeting with the students. We wanted to sit down with them. We wanted to hear from them firsthand what they was going through. And when we got to the list of requests and we read through the requests, and then we read through that 1969 document, we was utterly shocked that they were similar and nothing happened. So we set up a meeting with the chancellor, went over there and talked to the chancellor, and our goal is to actually assist and to help out. And I told the students that we're playing a secondary role in supporting you, but legislatively, we're definitely going to be looking at the college and what is happening via our tax dollars and what's not happening to ensure that students that are going to our universities are included into that university.
The other place where the General Assembly has some touch on the university is in the Senate's confirmation of the Board of Curators. Mm-hmm. Are you satisfied with how the Board of Curators has responded over the last couple of weeks?
No, and some of this stuff I can't go into detail about, but what I can say is when you have a chancellor on campus that's trying to work on race relations and he can't implement anything, then it has to come, it has to be restrictions from the person that's over him, and that would be the board.
So you're talking about the president.
The president of the board.
And do you feel like the in accepting Tim Wolf's resignation and in accepting the transfer of Brody Lofton as chancellor to a different role, like that, those are positive steps by the board? Or do you feel like they have more to do?
No, they have a lot more to do. In regards to Mr. Wolf, I have issues with the lack of attention that he does with so-called minorities, and the word minority doesn't mean black. So last year was a case that we tried to get involved in with a young woman that was raped on campus. Was pretty much covered up, hush hush. So it's a lot of things that I believe the president should have been proactively seeking to fix or seeking to engage in to make sure that it was palatable for everybody that was involved. With the chancellor, my personal opinion is that was the wrong move by the department heads. And sitting down talking to the chancellor, and I know the chancellor previously, I actually feel like the chancellor is somebody that is genuinely concerned about inclusion and is genuinely concerned about improving that campus. With the coach resignation, I have a lot of red flags that popped in my head because he's the winningest coach at Mizzou. I believe his record was 117-71, and he's been there for 17 years. And I know he has health issues, but I find the timing is just funny because he found out about it last year, and in 2 days after the protest stops, he resigns.
I have a question for you, Representative Ellington, about we've heard a lot of critics on the right complain about a clash of values on the campus, namely the students demanding that their space be respected, and on the other hand, allegedly suppressing free speech, as infamously now exemplified by the case of the communications professor at MU who sided with the students and attempted to muzzle a photographer there. On the other hand, we have an interesting case on the other side of a colleague of yours in the state legislature, mm-hmm. Republican Senator Kurt Schaefer, who chairs the State Senate Committee on Sanctity of Life, who sent a letter to the university last month, I believe it was, claiming that a graduate student who was studying Missouri's 72-hour waiting period for abortion is a marketing aid, quote-unquote, for Planned Parenthood, and he wants documentation on how the research was approved and wants the university to end it. Your comments, please, about your colleague, Senator Schaefer.
Utterly ridiculous, because you can't – the issue that I have with people that are in office – is that you can't contradict yourself, because if you contradict yourself, then that means you have no moralistic ground that you're standing on. So if you say in one hand that the free speech should be protected, that reporters should be able to be there, students, reporters should be able to report it, there should be no restrictions, then how can you turn around on the other hand and say that a student can't research Planned Parenthood because you have a political issue against Planned Parenthood? But to the first sentiment of your comment, And I actually had an interview yesterday, and they were saying that it was wrong that the students don't want to talk to the press. They were saying it was wrong for the professor. And I'm not agreeing with what the professor did or how she did it, but you have to understand the reasoning behind certain actions. When you have students that are afraid for their life, and they're not only afraid for racial issues, they're afraid of their teachers, they're afraid of their professors, they're afraid that campus security isn't going to protect them. So I can understand their unwillingness to want to talk to the media. I can understand their unwillingness to want to engage with anybody beyond that campus, because the folks on that campus that they're supposed to be able to have the belief that they're protecting them are showing them callousness. So I can understand their hesitation. But in saying that, they have to be better at utilizing the media to get the message out, because right now they're being portrayed as a bunch of angry kids. And I'm telling you, that's not the case. And I wish people could just go up there and talk to them, because they will understand how not only intelligent, but how relevant their issues are. And again, I just wish people can actually see it for themselves.
Dan Curry, you're sitting here quietly. You're obviously deep in thought. What are you thinking about?
Well, I'm just thinking, is this a problem that is specific to the MU campus, or is this something that's you see in other colleges around Missouri, you know, like UMKC, for instance? I wonder if it's just happens to be something that's intrinsic to Columbia, perhaps, that's causing these students to feel unsafe there.
Yeah, well, let me tack on to that question. You actually led a forum, an event at UMKC this week, talking about racism, something that had been scheduled long before the events of the last couple of weeks. Compare the situation locally, if you will.
No, I definitely can. The demographics around Columbia is different than the demographics around UMKC. So in Kansas City, we have a more cross-connecting between the social construct of the races. And also a little bit more understanding of culture than they do in Columbia. So in Columbia, you have organizations that's tied into the KKK, the Knights of Columbus, and all this other stuff that constantly has racist mantras and racist models. And that's one of the reasons that a majority of professors leave. Because around that area, the professors, the African-Americans, Latino professors, they're treated with disrespect. They're belittled, they're degraded, in the whole nine. So on that campus, you have already a weird racial element. And that was some of the things that the chancellor was, the old Chancellor Laughlin was aware of and was trying to work on. In Kansas City, we have some issues, but the larger scope is a lack of honesty about the social construct of race, race relations, and deconstructing barriers that have become institutionalized. And I believe the minute we start being more honest about the social construct, race, and culture, because they're not synonymous, they're different. And the minute we start to have open and honest conversations, that's why I did it at UMKC, we can start to break down the barriers. I haven't met a white person yet that we don't have similarities with certain things that we like, certain things that we want to do, and it's the same with the Republicans. We have a lot of differences in ideologies, but when you talk about fundamental core beliefs and fundamental core things that we want, it's almost universal. I don't know anybody that doesn't want shelter. I don't know anybody that doesn't want their children to be able to be safe. I don't know anybody that wants to live in an unsafe neighborhood. I don't know anybody that don't want a job that they can be happy and make a livable wage at. I don't know anybody that doesn't want any of these makeups. Now, I do see a lot of social colonization and social separation, and which leads to oppression and ignorance. And I believe the more we're honest, we can start to debunk a lot of the ignorance. And then we can work on a society that's beneficial for everyone, as opposed to beneficial to only a small few, while everybody else is working against each other because we believe that we're different.
Before we get away from this, I should say, in disclosure, that KCUR, which produces this podcast, is an editorially independent station, but is licensed to the Board of Curators of the University of Missouri. And of course, we're housed here at UMKC. Brandon, I want to ask you, you're the chair of the Legislative Black Caucus in Missouri, a state that now twice in the last couple of years has made national news with pretty significant racially tinged issues, or issues that are all about race. What, in your role as a legislative leader, What can be done? What are the steps that you would advocate for, recognizing that most if not all of the Black Caucus is Democratic?
Mm-hmm. Except for one.
You have one Republican. Okay. Obviously, maybe limited in terms of the levers of legislative power in the current Republican majorities in both the House and the Senate. But what can you do? What would the legislative agenda of the Black Caucus look like right now to address some of these concerns?
Now, I come back to the agenda. One of the things that we've been trying to do, especially me, is deconstruct and also educate. So, I'll give you an example. In one of the committees I have, Republican Searport, he came to me. He was like, "Hey, I wasn't going to vote this way, man, but after I listened to you, I got to seeing it from a different view." And that's what we have to do. As humans, we only learn two ways, observation and participation. So from the time you're a baby, you're observing and you're participating, whether that's academically, physically, et cetera. So the more that we observe and we participate in different information, we start to change. So when I talk about deconstruction, I use different instances to show how isolation is perpetuated. Even though somebody on face value may not be overtly racist or may not do anything to encourage racism or separation, the way the institution is designed, it perpetuates it. So I use the criminal justice example just to give a quick example. So with anybody that knows attorneys and my attorney friends that do defense work, I always talk to them about their benefiting from a system that they know is in bias. So I ask them, "Do you know it's in bias sentences law?" "Yeah." "Have you done anything to deconstruct that in the criminal justice arena?" "No." "Well, then you unintentionally benefiting from a system that was designed to keep people isolated, that was designed to keep people marginalized." And we can see this in our sentencing process, the resources that's in our corrections. And I also try to engage people on a different level, and I will stay with corrections. So like with some of my colleagues that don't have a lot of criminality in their district, I engage them on the fact that you're spending $72 per inmate per day when we could be spending $9 to actually educate people in school if we was to actually found the foundation formula, which would benefit everybody, because it's benefiting you because you no longer have to spend that $72. We knock that down to $9, and it benefits the impoverished communities because now we don't have to worry about a huge element of criminal activity because people can actually assimilate because they're educated, they can create their own jobs and businesses. So it's a lot that we have to do, but I believe the greatest thing we can do is deconstruct and reformat institutions.
Do you feel like the Legislative Black Caucus has a real voice at the table?
Yes, I definitely do. And that's one of the things I've been blessed to do. Since I've been there, I've been blessed to have great relationships on both sides of the aisles. But that's because I care less about party and more about issues. So if it's an issue on the table, I can go to the Republicans, we can go to the Democrats, and we can discuss the merits of these issues. You was right about the numbers, percentage-wise, but we've been blessed to be able to work with both parties to get marginal gains. And I say marginal gains because in Missouri, we're stuck playing partisan politics. So I have Republican colleagues that vote yes on bills that they know they don't want to vote yes on. But since the party is going to come down on them, they do what they have to do. Mm-hmm. And it's the same democratically. I wish we can get to a system where it was more issue-based, and I believe we would see faster movement on long-term issues.
You're not the first representative we've had sitting there who noting that the partisan realities are hard to work around in Jeff City. Jump in here, guys. What do you think?
I just wanted to get back to the Columbia campus, if I may, and ask the representative about something that you've said a couple of times. Namely, you've said that a lot of these students who were protesting felt that their very lives had been threatened. Mm-hmm. Where are these threats coming from?
Some of the threats are coming via social media. Some of the threats was coming around the speaker circle. The speaker circle is where they initially was demonstrating that, which is outside the outside the chancellor's office. But again, the sentiment, when you call the police and you say that you're afraid for your life and the police take 8 hours to show up, you start to lose confidence. When you go to class and the professor tells you that because one of the things they're asking for is diversity in the classroom. And the teacher tells you that by diversifying the classroom would destroy the university. You lose faith in that university. You definitely lose faith that they care about your concerns. And you should lose faith that they're going to protect you. So all of these heightens the sensitivity of fear. And again, this is not a new issue. It has been going on for at least 40 years, looking at the documents in 1969. And if me and you was living in the same domicile and you came to me every day and you was like, Brandon, I feel unsafe. Brandon, I feel unsafe. After a while, you're going to stop believing that I care about you, and you're going to believe that anything that I do is to intentionally hurt you. And that's part of the sentiment that's happening at the campus right now. You have students that are seeking out for help, speaking out for help, and they feel like they can't trust the administration. And then again, the demographics around the area is conducive for heightened racial tension and racial fear.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you're not just talking about students who feel affronted, whose sensibilities are affronted, there are people who are claiming that many of these students, at not just Mizzou, but at Yale, say, where there have been protests, are just coddled and indulged.
Yale protest is a little different. But when you're a graduate student and you've been in college for 6-8 years, and fear for life goes multiple ways. It goes physical. And then it goes into future. So if I'm a graduate student and I'm afraid that my professor is going to flunk me just because of the color of my skin or just because I'm opposing the institutionalized racism that exists, that knowingly exists at this campus, then I'm afraid that I'm going to lose my future livability. I've been working for this for 8 years, and I feel like I'm about to lose everything, not because of my academic attainment or lack thereof, but simply because of the color of my skin, or simply because I said, I don't want you to pull me out of class because I'm the only black student in the class and say, I want to hear rap music. And I know that you listen to rap music. All black people don't listen to rap music. But things like this adds to uncertainty, and it definitely adds to fear.
So are there legislative ways to address
some of that?
I mean, some of this is a change of culture that mm-hmm. that is a generation or more in the making, right? But you actually think you can accomplish some of those things through your work in the General Assembly?
It's twofold when we talk about the university. A lot of it is policies that is going to have to be implemented via the campus. From the legislative body, though, we have authority when we talk about different things. So I would use MU and the polarization of other colleges around here that many people don't pay attention to. Now, this is quasi-politics. So you have Mizzou was working to guarantee that no other universities would be able to have a law school. They was even working to remove UMKC's law school. Now, this is quasi-politics, and it goes into the heart of control. These are things that we can actually block or at least create huge problems for legislatively. The same when we talk about the allocation of colleges. Missouri is a land-grant university. Lincoln University is a land-grant university. These allocations are allocated via the legislative body. We see drastic imbalances in the allocation. At the state, we don't match the LU match that we're supposed to match, but we overly match the Mizzou match. I believe Mizzou got I don't like to be wrong. It was a little over 100-something million last year. That's not the exact total, but it definitely was over 100 million. But I don't like to throw out wrong numbers. I'm not okay. Trump.
Sure. Dan, you're stroking your chin thoughtfully.
Did you have a chance to read Jason Whitlock's article on what happened there?
No, I didn't. I know which one you're talking about, but I have not seen it yet. I have not read it.
He made a lot of points, and some of them were pretty sensationalistic, I thought. Some of them were kind of entertaining. Mm. One of them, though, that I thought I wanted to ask you about was, do you think that the fact that this is happening on a college campus, which some people might perceive as a bubble and not reality, mm-hmm. does that lessen what's going on there? Because Whitlock said, why aren't they protesting in Chicago where people are actually getting killed, mm-hmm.
Yes and no. And this is one of the interesting things. The students, they never meant for all the media attention. They actually wanted the systemic changes. So when they started protesting and demonstrating, they was doing it because they had a list from 1969 to the day that they wanted done. And it's almost identical. So yes and no. Yes, it's in a bubble. But the one good thing about it being on the college campus is you have a lot of students that don't have the same sentiments as the administration. So you have a lot of students of different cultures that actually is sympathetic and has observed the same things that the so-called minority students are talking about. So it's a good thing for the students because the students can actually work towards a lot of the deconstruction. It's a bad thing at the university because by being at a university, it's able to be maintained and controlled by that university. And I believe, I don't have facts, but I believe that's one of the reasons that we're seeing multiple resignations from people that have been supportive of the students because they can control that. They can control putting pressure on the administrator. They can control getting that administrator out of that campus, and they can keep the climate where they want it at. When you have professors, and when I talk to the students, they say they have several professors that they can go talk to, but those professors can't do anything to help them because they're in the same situation that they're in. If I speak out, I'm going to lose my job. And see, I got a family. I need to support my family. Even though I know what's going on is wrong, I want to talk to you and try to talk you through it, I can't make any realistic opposition because the campus controls everything about me and my profession. So it's an extremely negative thing with the bubble, but I definitely want to articulate they was not doing it for any sensational reason. They was actually, when it started, they wanted to sit down and negotiate and get these requests met, or at least get as many requests as they could. And again, Chancellor Lofton was opening his door to hold conversations with these students when the hunger strike first started. And now Chancellor Lofton was requested to resign by the 9 department heads. And you have to ask yourself why. He's only been there for a year. It's not like he's been there for 20 years and you could be like, well, he's never done anything. Since he came in the door, he's seen this and he was trying to address it. He's seen the sentiment around the college and he was trying to address it. He even had issues with the lack of retention for the so-called minority teachers. And it's not the departments that the teachers is in, it's all everything else around there. So he was extremely aware and concerned, but they asked him to leave.
Sounds like you don't think Lofton should have resigned.
My opinion, I like Lofton. Anybody that I can sit down with and we can hold educated conversations and also talk about creating solutions, and I believe that they're genuine, yes, I would love to have worked with him. Not saying anything about the interim chancellor. I don't even know him. I have a meeting with him set up for Monday. But I'm just speaking out of my personal experiences, and also I'm speaking out of the understanding of oppression and colonization. Everybody isn't racist. Everybody isn't bad. But we're colonizing. Colonization is the conscious separation of groups, right? So we separate blacks from whites. We separate Latinos. We separate gays from women and the whole nine. And we have a system of systematic oppression as opposed to a system of systematic inclusion. And a lot of that can be dismantled by changing certain policies. So when we talk about the policy of diversifying literature, when I read something from an Asian author, I start to understand from an Asian's lens. When I read something for a European author, I start to understand something from a European lens. The same when I read something from an African author, which only gives me greater culturalistic understanding. So that's something that we should be mandating in not only our high schools, but our universities.
Putting those in like introductory courses, yeah, required for everyone, not sectioned off into an Asian literature course.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Before we go, I want to look ahead a little bit to the 2016 legislative session the sense that you have of what the priorities, whether there's likely to be significant progress on a number of issues that came up in 2015, but no legislation emerged or vetoes that were not overridden. In particular, certain issues like right to work are likely to be on the agenda again. What are you looking forward to in the 2016 legislative session?
The end of the 2016 legislator. And I say that being...
And it's only 2015. Yeah. You're already looking forward to the end.
Because, and I'm saying this being cynical, but being honest, next year is election year. So you're going to see a lot of superficial bills that are going to be highlighted. You're going to see a lot of bills that are divisive to go to partisan bases. And again, this is one of the most detrimental things that we have happening in politics. Last year, we had very little movement on any bill, whether that was Republican or Democrat, because the Speaker Deal, He changed the entire design of the committees. This year, I believe we're going to see the same thing. And when we talk about stuff like right to work, when we talk about cutting employment benefits, when we talk about cutting social services, this benefits nobody. And again, it's partisan driven. Because when we look at the highest pockets of poverty, the highest pockets of social programs, we're talking about rural areas. When we look at the lack of expanded Medicaid, we're talking about benefiting rural areas. It benefit Kansas City and St. Louis, but we have more than one hospital. So when we look at the hospitals that are proposed to be closed, they're being proposed to be closed in rural areas. So a lot of the big issues are not getting tackled because we're doing partisan politics, even when you talk about right to work. Missouri is just got ranked as far as one of the best states to be able to start a business in. But we want to take the ability for people to negotiate their wages away from them, which I don't understand from my Republican colleagues, because they always talk about liberty and freedom. So you will believe that people should have the liberty and freedom to organize. But I think it's going to be a stagnant session. I do look forward to working with Speaker Richardson. We have a good relationship in some of the criminal justice bills. I believe we should be able to move forward. Last year, Speaker Deal had a knee-jerk reaction to anything that dealt with any type of criminal justice reform, police reform,
so
anything.
So you introduced a bill last year that would have required police officers to wear a camera, for example, and it didn't get out of committee.
Which is funny, because the year before that I introduced it and I had Republican support. But this year when I introduced it, they thought I did it because of Mike Brown. But we moved it last year before Mike Brown got killed.
As the health editor here, I'm very pleased that you broached the topic of Medicaid expansion. And very quickly, just want to ask you, what do you think the prospects for Medicaid expansion in the state of Missouri are?
Slim to none. We've had two or three Republicans resign from the House because they can't work on Medicaid expansion. Chris Mullendorf was one of the Republicans that resigned a few years ago because he couldn't work on Medicaid expansion. Senator Sylvie has proposed several proposals in which the state wouldn't have any obligation, and they couldn't pass that. But again, it's partisan driven. It has nothing to do with the 250 or 350,000 people that would immediately benefit. It has nothing to do with the rural areas that desperately need Medicaid expansion. It has nothing to do with the chambers of Congress coming out saying, hey, this is utterly ridiculous that we're not expanding. It's all partisan driven. And I know a lot of Republicans at the state in the House that would vote yes on that bill, but they can't, because they're afraid of retaliation from their party. And their party actually retaliates against their members. It's members that voted for us, voted with the Democrats for right to work. And as soon as they left the floor, they already had commercials running against them, talking about they was rhinos and they was traitors to the party.
Rhinos, Republicans in name only.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. So that was great last question from you, Dan Margulies. Dan Curry, last question?
No.
But just a last comment.
Last comment is, it was nice being here. Nice getting to meet you, Mr. Ellington, and look forward to seeing you try to get something done next year.
Well, thank you.
That's Dan Curry. He's an attorney, lives in the Troostwood neighborhood. Thank you for being here. And Dan Margulies of the Heartland Health Monitor and here at KCUR 89.3. Good to see you, Dan.
Good to see you.
So Brandon Ellington, representative, Democrat from Kansas City and chair of the Missouri Legislative Black Caucus, thank you for being here with us.
No, thank you.
Now, in an effort to get to know you a little bit better, we always close the show with a song of your choosing. Is there a favorite song or a song that's been on your mind the last week or two that we can close with today?
I don't think I can close with it because I still listen to rap. I listen to 90s rap, not anything new.
we can close with 90s rap if you can.
Oh, y'all got anything from Tupac?
Something from Tupac.
We don't care what it is.
Okay.
Your mom is nodding his head yes.
The producer says yes. You don't care what it is. We will make the choice. And thanks so much for being here.
I know, it's fun.
Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp, the finder of a Tupac song to play. You can find us on iTunes or on kcur.org/statehouseblend. If you use Twitter, do you use Twitter? Yes, we use Twitter. It's a good way to keep up on the show and the news from Jeff City and Topeka as well. I'm at PTS Brian. You can follow my co-host, Sam Zeff. He's at Sam Zeff. We use the hashtag Statehouse Blend. Don't forget to listen to us on Tuesday mornings as part of Up to Date, the little abbreviated version of the show that'll air at 11 a.m. on KCUR 89.3. And if you'd like to be one of our guests on the show, if you have any other thoughts, send me an email. I'm at brian@kcur.org. Brian Ellison, see you next time.